are, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. We're back in this situation where the Democrats have tried to galvanize mass support behind a candidate who's manifestly not up to the job. And there is a failure to just acknowledge, you know, what Americans saw and heard, you know, loud and clear last night.
And Derek Hamilton, founding director of Institute on Race, Power and Political Economy at the New School. You just have 20 seconds.
You know, what is lost and sad in the messaging from this debate is some of the unprecedented interventions that happened during the pandemic, as dramatic as that was, especially in contrast to the Great Recession, where we invested directly in the American people. We should be building upon that.
Derek Hamilton, Institute on Race, Power and Political Economy at the New School. Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We also want to thank Norman Solomon of the Institute for Public Accuracy, as well as Michelle Goodwin at Georgetown. And finally, Silky Shaw of Detention Watch and Dean Baker. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. It's Director of Development. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
Are you eloquent in elephant? Can you converse in chimpanzee? Have a heart-to-heart in horse or chat with a cow? Me neither, but we can definitely speak for them. Hi, I'm Michelle Coppola, inviting you to join me every fourth Friday of the month at 10 a.m. for Voices for the Animals, where we give a voice to the issues, concerns, and welfare of the other non-human creatures on the planet. Until we can have in-depth discussions in dolphin or yak, well, in yak, it's a great way to learn about how we can make this a more humane world. Voices for the Animals, every fourth Friday of the month at 10 a.m. only here on KBOO.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Althea Billings, one of the co-hosts of the Friday morning talk show, The Gap. Our show is off this morning, but Tammy and I wish you all well and hope to be back on your radio soon. Now, please enjoy this.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Burn Scars, a poetic reckoning with wildfires, I will be interviewing Margaret Alija Garcia, author and poet published by El Martillo Press. Margaret Alija Garcia is the author of the short story collection Graft, the poetry chapbook Burn Scars, and the debut poetry collection The Daughterland Poems. She is the editor of the forthcoming Red Flag Warning Anthology. She teaches poetry with the Community Literary Initiative and writes a history column for High Country Life magazine in Northeastern California. She's currently working on her second collection of poems, Watershed, also to be released by El Martillo Press. Margaret Alija Garcia has spent a couple of decades living in Greenville, a gold rush-era Northern California town that no longer exists as it did in 2021. That's because it was devoured by the Dixie Fire, one of the largest blazes in California history. Margaret began writing her poetry collection Burn Scars while waiting at traffic stops driving from her mother's house to her former hometown. She grappled with the destructive aftermath that began with a eulogy and ended with a 79-page poetry book memoir. On today's show, we discuss with Margaret how poetry serves as a vehicle to process, mourn, and raise awareness around climate disruption while honoring those on the front lines. She shares her poetry and tells us how a town of marginal income set in dense forests was almost completely destroyed. Margaret relates how the fire started near Pacific Gas and Electric Power Station and spread at an incomprehensible rate as a result of gusty winds and historically dry conditions. Thankfully, no lives were lost, but the fire resulted in significant losses of property and livelihoods with major challenges for rebuilding. One thing's for sure, lots of lessons were learned and stronger community bonds were built. Thank you for tuning in to Eco Justice Radio and our show, Burn Scars, a poetic reckoning with wildfires. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and it is my honor to welcome our guest, Margaret Alija Garcia, author and poet, published by El Martillo Press. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, Margaret. You, like I said in the intro, you are a poet. You lived in the northern Sierra Nevada town of Greenville, California, a town that dates back to California's Gold Rush era. And for our listeners, Greenville is about 2 hours north of Lake Tahoe or Reno, Nevada. But then on July 13th, 2021, there was this fire, the Dixie Fire, a huge, devastating fire, and that was not contained until October 25th. In its wrath, it decimated much of the small community of Greenville, where you live. As a poet, you have taken your experience and that of the community and put pen to paper. Today, I want to hear about your experience and have you share your poetry with us. So before we jump in, briefly explain, because there's so much to share and so much beautiful poetry that our listeners get to enjoy. Briefly explain why you use poetry to raise awareness and environmental consciousness.
Yeah, well, a couple of things come to mind. I always wrote poetry first, and poetry always seemed the most personal. I do a lot of article writing and fiction, but poetry to me has always been my kind of immediate home base. And I didn't feel like creating characters or anything. I wanted the chapbook Burn Scars to be really immediate. And also, I really wanted to raise awareness because the news coverage, and I was a reporter at the time in the area, the news coverage from outside of the area was so horrible that I really wanted us to like grab some control of our own narrative as it was being disseminated out much differently than we thought it was going to be. And now, of course, I'm working on Watershed Manuscript, which kind of refines a lot of the Burn Scar poems and kind of moves past what we're all going through now 2 years later as people are trying to, you know, rebuild and coming up against roadblocks for that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that rebuild and what's happening and the roadblocks that they have met. Set the stage for us. Tell us about the town of Greenville prior to the fire in 2021. What was the demographics? What was the population? Why was it considered an historic town?
So it does date back to the Gold Rush, but I don't think any of us actually thought of it as a historic town. It was not the county seat, and so it only had about 1,200 people, and more like 900 in the winter, 1,200 in the summer. We had a few buildings that dated back to the 1890s. All those were taken by the fire. But it's mostly made up of like old settler families from the Gold Rush who went into ranching and mining. And then the Native American tribe, the Maidu, Mountain Maidu, lived there. There's a few Latinx families of which my family was a part, and a few African American families. But yeah, that's who's up there. A lot of retirees. Median income up there it's like 28,000, mostly retirees. What I like to also tell people about Greenville is we had the distinction of the most PhDs and artists anywhere in the county, and also the most high school dropouts and the lowest incomes. So so that was us.
That's a broad spectrum, yeah.
So
let's talk about the fire. On July 13th, 2021, the Dixie Fire broke out and, as we've said, nearly destroyed much of the town of Greenville.
How much was destroyed in its path, and how long did it take to put out?
Yeah, so it took out about 800 buildings in the area, 1,329 structures, nearly a million acres burned. And I know it's hard for anyone to imagine what a million acres looks like. It's the largest non-complex fire in California history. And if you can think of it, somebody not too long ago told me, like, it's if you went from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco and burned everything along the I-80 up to Sacramento, that could give you an idea of how much burned.
So, oh my gosh. Like my mouth just dropped.
Yeah. So that's a rough comparison, but square footage, that's about the same.
So, and when you say non-complex fire for our listeners, what does that mean?
So a lot of times in fire season, you could have multiple fires. Like if there's a lightning storm, you might have three or four, and they could start burning towards each other. And then that's a complex fire when you had like four mini fires and they became one big fire. But the Dixie Fire is distinctive because it was one giant fire. There's not a bunch of little fires that joined up with this one. This was one giant fire.
And in this, it wasn't just Greenville that was affected, right? There's all these other cities, Indian Falls.
Yeah, it actually took Indian Falls at the end of July. So 2 weeks before Greenville burned, Indian Falls burned. And that was like a community of like 54 houses. There's 9 houses left in that area. And it took
there's 54 houses and there's currently 9 houses left.
Yeah. And the community of Canyon Dam, which probably had about 50 people who lived there, that whole community's gone. Nothing survived in Canyon Dam at all. And that was right by the lake. So that these are all about, I would say all these towns are about 20 minutes apart driving. But a lot of windy roads, so maybe these are all about 12 to 20 miles apart. And then there was this really cool historic off-the-grid area called Warner Valley up by Mount Lassa National Park, and it had all these old houses. It was totally off the grid. You could only access it spring to early September. The roads didn't go all the way through in the winter, and that whole place is gone. And they can't rebuild because a lot of it was inherited property, and people would come up over the summer. It's not necessarily people of means. It's just people who had these like little shacks up there that their great-great-grandfather had. And none of those can be rebuilt because they're all considered second homes. So there's no way to rebuild.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. You can only get compensation and help on a home you're actually living in.
Wow. Well, you lived through this and you're one of the people in Greenville. You live in Los Angeles now. You released a publication, what's called a chap book of poetry called Burn Scars, based on your experience with the Dixie Fire. You will be sharing some of that poetry throughout the show, but first, in a general sense, how did your experience with the Dixie Fire shape this publication and your poetry?
I mean, for me, I really did struggle with everything, thoughts and emotions. And I should backtrack and say that I was a reporter of the area at the same time. And so that was a lot of double duty of, reporting on the story and then turning around and being the story, which was very uncomfortable when you're trying to come at it from one angle and then another. And the poetry chapbook just for me was trying to write down things so I wouldn't forget, first of all. And I had a lot of neighbors knew that I write because they've been a reporter in the area for a long time. And so I did have a lot of people emailing me and texting me like, you're going to write about this, right? You're going to write about this. And I was like, yeah, I guess. And I was working on other projects, but I kept like writing a little poem here and there. And then all of a sudden I had 80 poems about fire. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I have a book about fire. And, it's for us in the community, it was like we're all just coming out of COVID. My son and daughter were in high school, like trying to deal with the end of that. And then all of a sudden the fire, it really screwed up my daughter's senior year. And I just felt like people outside of Greenville and the neighboring towns, like Quincy, where she went to school and where I work, like once the fire was out in October, people are like, oh, okay. And just like going back to normal in a way and not really, you know, kind of being annoyed at people from Greenville who were not, clearly we were all traumatized and weren't bouncing back. You know? And I have to say, you know, every summer, somebody somewhere gets evacuated, right? That's a normal thing in Northern California. It's like,
it's becoming a normal thing across the United States and the world.
And so we always expect like someone's going to be evacuated somewhere, but this was huge and not something we bounced back from. And I took actually some inspiration from Anna Akhmatova, the Russian poet, because I was reading, I love her work, and I was reading something in a biography of how she was in a bread line or something, and people came up to her and they were like, "You're that famous poet. You know, are you going to try to describe this before, like, we're not allowed to describe it anymore?" And all that sort of stuff. So that kind of stuck with to, and I kept a notebook in the car of things that were like making me angry.
Well, let's share one of those pieces. Your poem Eulogy for Greenville, I think would be a great place to start. And that's from your publication again called Burn Scars.
Okay. So, and this speaks to the character of Greenville. My defiantly quirky, beautiful adopted hometown turned into a ghost town last night. There's so many things I could tell you about Greenville. There was over 1,000 people in change, though the population still said, signs still said 2,000. We all have an opinion here about everything. We are a microcosm of America and often frustrated with each other. Greenville is filled with do-gooder volunteers, retirees, hippies, bikers, rednecks, ranchers, cowboys, mountain maidu, and a chunk of people who never felt like the town they were born into someplace else in California was quite the right fit for them. We were extended families and single moms and dads. We were drunks, we were sober, and we tried not to be too judgmental lest someone judge us back. And we were recent survivors from paradise too. So I'll just stop there, but that should give you a little taste of that. And I end that part on paradise too, because a lot of people escaping the Camp Fire in 2018 moved to Greenville because it was more affordable. So we had a lot of people in the community who got burned out twice.
And paradise for our listeners was the massive fire that took out the full city of Paradise, Camp Fire.
Yeah.
Which got a lot of coverage, more so than Greenville. The fire, we talked about this before, but the fire moved very quickly. It burned 963,309 acres across 5 counties in Northern California from July 15th to October 25th. How quickly it took over Greenville is incredibly unbelievable. Can you speak to the day of the fire and how the fire was managed, or maybe not so managed in this case?
Sure. So first thing I'll say is our firefighters did an amazing job of doing everything they could. At the time of the fire, there was at least 53 fires in Northern California. I'm not so sure about the rest of the state. And so it was all hands on deck, and they were understaffed. The whole state was understaffed for fire. But the geography of Greenville is kind of against it. Greenville was known as, or Indian Valley, where Greenville sits, is known as like the most beautiful part of the whole county. And mostly because it has this stark, flat valley floor. And then it goes, there's hardly any incline. There's just these giant, majestic mountains that surround the valley. And unfortunately, it was surrounded, right? And so the fire, if you look at a picture of the Dixie Fire, you see it's like this giant dragon of a circle with no escape. So that was really hard. We'd been evacuated for 13 days beforehand, and they'd done a really good job on the dozer lines on the mountains above. So they really thought they could hold it. But unfortunately, we had super high winds that we've never seen a wind like that. and they had flames going up a mile in the air and debris flying everywhere. So the amount of spot fires from it were crazy. And this is a time of drought. And so our reservoirs were low. Water pressure was low. No house that was on city water survived. A lot of houses that did survive were ones that were on their own well and not directly downtown. So yeah, it was over 100 degrees every day from May to July, sometimes getting up to 110, never getting below 93. And we had no snow that winter. So this is kind of like a perfect climate change storm of factors. You had PG&E's negligence, coupled with the high winds, the drought. And I have to credit our sheriff and supervisor and firefighters, because we didn't lose any people. And that is entirely on them.
Amazing. I mean, 8 minutes, the thing blew up in 8 minutes and you lost no people.
Yeah.
That's applaud to them. Thank God. Well, we're going to take a break real quick. Listeners, stay tuned, because we're going to start the next chapter here, reading a piece of poetry called The War. And so we're going to continue this conversation. We'll also talk about the role that P&G played. So please stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. You can check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Burn Scars, A Poetic Reckoning with Wildfires. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and our guest today is Margaret Alija Garcia, author and poet published by El Martillo Press.
Welcome back, everyone. I want to start by, Margaret, having you read another one of your pieces called The War, and that depicts the quickness of the fire, which we just talked about, how the fire took 8 minutes to blow up. The emergency teams did an amazing job. And so if you could read The War and then share with us any further thoughts on this poem.
The War. At first, they said it took less than an hour for Greenville to burn, that the propane tanks blew up like terrorist bombs, that the wind picked up and the embers flew like missiles over the heads of firefighters, some of who watched in those seconds their own houses catch and burn. Fireballs down Main Street like the mouth of a dragon, twisting lampposts and blackening trees, incinerating horses and cows still in the fields, disintegrating orchards, vaporizing cabins, investigating, revisiting. It took just 8 minutes to blow up my town. Inspiration for that was I was interviewing some firefighters downtown for another story and hearing them starting to talk about how it was for them that day and what things looked like. And I thought that wasn't in any of the reports I had seen on the news. So I wanted to cover smaller things that hadn't been covered yet.
We talked about, you know, how quick the fire spread. What did the evacuation of Greenville look like? How did the lessons of the 2018 campfire, Paradise, that happened in Northern California's Butte County, how did that actually help to save lives in Greenville?
Well, we took it very seriously. And I think in past years, people had thought of fire differently in Plumas County. We were like, oh, it's in a remote area. You know, it's in that canyon over there that nobody can get to. It's rugged. There's a lot of rock. It'll go out on its own or they'll get it. And this, ever since Paradise, we learned that, like, no, it can take your whole town. And we knew that from other towns in Northern California, too, in this area called Berry Creek, also in Butte. So we knew to take it seriously, and Sheriff Todd Johns, our sheriff, is actually from Greenville and really took it upon himself to get people out. So we were evacuated for 12 days prior to the fire taking Greenville, and we were actually just all called back. So they had done such a great job with the dozer lines, and it looked like the wind was going in the other direction. And so they actually had called people home about, I want to say, probably about 17 hours before the fire took Greenville. And then the wind shifted, the fire went over the dozer lines because the wind took it. And so then an immediate re-evacuation was called for people to go back out. And so for a lot of people, the second evacuation was way more difficult. Everyone had good planning at the beginning for the first evacuation, right? Take all the important papers, get the pets and everything. But people were tired because they were living out of their car in motels, camping for 12 days. So they brought everything back and nobody was prepared to turn around again. So people lost pets because they let their pets out. They had let their horses back. So that time was just not enough time to gather everything back up and out again. So it was really devastating for a lot of people. But there's no way for those in charge to know that all the work they did, right, was textbook to fight a fire. And they had no idea that nothing they knew about fire was going to be enough for this one.
No, no, that's devastating. I'm so sorry. Many people haven't gone through fire. You know, many people don't have this experience. And for those that have not gone through a natural disaster, it's hard for them to convey their experience, or for those that have, right, to convey their experience and their emotions. And you're helping others do so through poetry. In your piece, Mayday, you address your emotions and what happened to you versus others. Can you read from this poem for us?
Yeah, I'd love to. And this comes, you know, not a year after the fire, but like 9 months after. Mayday. This morning, you're just driving to work. For months, you've relied on little pyramids of ash, clunky heaps of rust, your eyes settling for these new landscapes. Your thoughts travel long distances, wait at traffic stops between logging and utility trucks and the stray tourist hybrid vehicle. Yours are numb, clinical thoughts, deadened by dry years, concrete rubble, twisted rebar searing skyward. This morning, bulldozers dump what's left of your life in giant metal bins. You will no longer sneak beyond caution tape at dusk to sit with your wreckage. It has to go. It all has to go. And you know this, but it feels like just one more thing taken from you when you weren't looking. I wrote that at a traffic stop. So what they don't tell you about, not that anybody tells you about fire, you know, recovery, but I think the big thing that hit the most of us after our town was gone was that we went from being able to get somewhere in 15 minutes to taking maybe 90 minutes because they would close the roads and take out trees that were half dead or could fall in the roadway or whatever. And so you just keep being impacted by fire. And I really got used to my office of 11 years being like, oh, there's my burnt out filing cabinet and there's my desk and there are the ashes of the 954 books that burned and all that. And then one day my area was one of the last ones to be cleared. And I was like, oh, and I thought, well, this is stupid, Margaret. Like, they can't rebuild if they don't take it away. But I was really upset it was taken away. And, you know, I talked to a bunch of other people who were like, they took my stuff, you know, and of course, it's all burnt. It's not like you're using the stuff or can.
It makes it real. It makes another level of real.
Definitely another level of real. And that was the last of our landmarks to be able to find where things were and where people were.
And just so your history, right? Like you had something physical, whether it was an ash or not, it was there. And you're like, that is mine. That is my history. That is, you know, my work, whatever it might be. And then eventually it's just gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't imagine. It's like, I would imagine, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but that it's like multiple losses. It's not, it's like the loss of the fire, then the loss, you know, just multiple losses back to back to back to back. It's not just a clean cut.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly kind of, it's one frustration after another. Like you think you're like, okay, I have a handle on this, this is fine. And then like one other thing happens and another thing happens. So, and I think a big thing for me was my husband and I bought 8 acres of former logging property that we were going to restore. And we're still trying to restore it, even though most of it burned. But our neighbor to the left of us decided just to clear cut everything and not wait to see what came back. Because government agencies were there for free if you did it right away. And so your more environmentalist people are like, well, let's see what comes back, right? You know, let's see how much we can salvage out of this. But if you wanted an agency to pay for it, you didn't really have a choice and you had to just like go with it. Yeah. So there's a lot of clear cutting that didn't need to happen that's happened.
Yeah. It's easier and cheaper to clear cut than it is to do land management, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some other responsibilities. PG&E.
Yeah.
They were held responsible for the fire and, you know, they were supposed to be held responsible. So were they held responsible? And what have they done to support any form of rebuild?
So it's kind of a threefold thing. PG&E knew they were going to be found negligent. They prepared. They had first.
Oh, did they?
I mean,
am I wrong? But weren't they also responsible?
85 people's deaths
for the Paradise Fire. Yeah. Okay. Sorry,
and
keep going.
The campfire that took Paradise and the Dixie Fire that took Greenville happened in the same canyon in like the same area. So no lessons were learned from 2018 going forward to 2021 by PG&E. And
wasn't it the same device? Like the same failure? Let's talk about that real quick. What failed?
It started because which happens in windstorms in the mountains, not a whole tree, but a limb fell on a power line. And that caused the fire. However, they also have extremely antiquated equipment that they were supposed to be replacing after the campfire and had not gotten around to it. And the area in the canyon where it started is very rugged. It's hard to get to. And you would think that would be an area that you would want to make sure was okay, just because it's so hard to fight a fire in that area. We're talking really steep slopes that it's nearly impossible. And most of the time for an area like that, that's where they send the helicopters and airplanes to like douse it, that you can't fight those on the ground. So yeah, they knew about that. Since the fire, they've offered many people settlements, including myself. Full disclosure on that. I think anybody renting in the area definitely went with the PG&E settlement because it's probably more money than they would have had otherwise. But homeowners didn't get that much from PG&E. And I don't think all the claims are settled yet. I think maybe about half at this point. PG&E did do good faith donations to a whole mess of organizations to the tune of like $32 million to organizations that were helping with the fire. So pretty much all the nonprofits in the area that work with the environment and or work with communities got a slice of the PG&E settlement. A lot of it was reimbursement for things they had already done out of hand. And they paid back salaries for firefighters, police, and whatnot. But Plumas County, which has a very lackadaisical board of kind of people with no background in governance, it settled for $7 million earlier this month. And Butte County, for reference, went for $35 million. And the other counties asked for more. But our board did not, for whatever reason, did not push back. And so they wound up settling for $7 million. So they're not getting as much as they should have gotten. for rebuild.
And I think you had said, not on the show, but mentioned that maybe rate increases and power outages are happening.
Yeah. So with another thing no one tells you, when you experience a forest fire where to that magnitude that the utilities are cut off, they brought everything back on generators. So we had horribly inefficient, very bad for the environment, generators for nearly 2 years. And those finally went away about 2 weeks ago. And in the place, they had buried some lines, not all lines, but the lines in and out of Greenville are now buried. And because of that, everyone got a notice that their rates are now going up because they have new and more efficient energy. But we still get power outages, and they now, which is good, they now, when there's a windstorm, turn off the power, which sounds weird that we're like, turn off the power, but turning off the power is what
safety. It's safety.
But they didn't do it beforehand, but they're doing it now. So it's frustrating to people that they're now paying more, it's shut off more often, and the generators are really wreaked havoc on people's appliances. I didn't know this before the fire, but everyone's refrigerator has died.
Oh, that's a thing.
That's a thing, and it's because you're not getting the generated electricity just wow. goes at different speed, and it messes with larger appliances.
What did the rebuild of Greenville look like so far? So after the 2021 Dixie Fire, what's happened?
So some things have come back. No surprise, those with insurance, which was about only a third of the town, those people with insurance are rebuilding. People without insurance aren't. So we'll have about a third of what we had downtown. There is an organization called Sierra Institute in nearby Taylorsville, and they actually help run a mill. It's the first new sawmill open in California in like 30 years. And so, and what's cool about that and the rebuild is that people can, they're down trees that are still able to do lumber. They can take them to the new mill. They can have them milled, and they can use their own lumber rather than having to purchase lumber on top of that to rebuild. And they also have cross-laminate timber that's, you know, more fire-resistant that they're building back with. So most of the places building back are definitely building back with more fire-resistant material. But again, that's not as many. So, yeah. And the first house that came back, it was largely because an extended family went in on it. So, but a nuclear family's done a hard time coming back. But a large extended family is the first one back. They had an old Victorian, don't have an old Victorian anymore, but they can now have a house, pulling resources between two.
Before we go to break, when we have a couple more minutes before break, I thought maybe you could read us another excerpt. The people living, as you said, in Greenville are not rich, and this has been their home forever. But there are people who are suggesting that those within, you know, areas that have experienced natural disasters in rural areas are prone to fire and they should move. Your piece in Burden Scholars called Real Estate addresses that insensitivity of those requests. Can you read an excerpt from Real Estate before we go to break?
UC Berkeley professors and coastal pundits tell us to go on, get out of here. It's no longer ethical to live in the woods, they say. They will keep having to save us, they say, as if they don't water their lawns with our water, as if they don't drink our sorrows from their taps. Where exactly are we supposed to live? Go on and tell a mostly native community and generations of settlers they need to leave. No one asks people at UC Berkeley whether it's ethical to live along the Hayward Fault. Move where exactly? I get lost in the absence of landmarks and trees on the road above my mother's house. Drunks and inexperienced drivers have often crashed into trees and lived to tell. Now the drunks will roll down the hills with no trees to stop them. Young people can't find places to live. I get 4 calls a day from people begging me to rent my mom's place to them. Maybe a spare room, maybe the garage. When your town burns down, you join a strange and exclusive club that will be far too inclusive soon. I am from a town that's gone. That's how we are on the map. We are finally on the map because we are erased from it. And that's my excerpt.
Wow. We're finally on the map because we were erased from it. Dang. That's pretty intense. Thank you for that. We will be right back. We're going to continue this conversation, share a few more pieces, also talk about some of the new pieces that you're doing around water in your watershed manuscript. So everyone, stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. You can check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Burn Scars, A Poetic Reckoning with Wildfires. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and our guest today is Margaret Alija Garcia, author and poet published by El Martillo Press.
Margaret, you've been sharing your poetry with us, talking about the Greenville fire and your experience and that of others, and how you've expressed through this chapbook what you went through, what others have gone through from the start all the way till today, years later. One of the beautiful things that you've mentioned to me that comes out of disaster is this connection that builds within the community, hopefully does build within the community. How through fire and natural disasters have you seen a stronger, or have seen stronger community bonds grow and even change, maybe from what they were prior to what they are now?
I think one of my favorite quotes about that comes from my former office mate. We were office mates for 12 years, and she's an environmental journalist, Jane Braxton Little. And she said, you know, she'd been there since the 60s. And she said, you know, I was always ambivalent about living up here. She lived up there because her husband was a hotshot firefighter running the helicopter. She's like, I was always ambivalent about being here, but now I'm defiant. And now, like, I'm a fight for it. And I was like, yeah, that's just it. Because, you know, it's this poor old downtrodden Greenville. And, like, you can't help but fight for it, and you're fighting along people of diametrically opposed political viewpoints, but there's not that many of you left, so you have to depend on each other. You can't take big political stands like, I'm not going to work with so-and-so because maybe that's the only thing. Like, my husband had to hire someone to help do the gravel for the property, and there was only one guy. Like, there's not enough of us to fight. And it really is a thing of having to stick together. And it's either sticking together locally against the county, which I guess there was some Board of Supervisors meeting today, and a whole bunch of people from Greenville showed up yelling at the Board of Supervisors for not spending money correctly and not having the money go towards Greenville. And, like, so you're having, like, old retirees and younger people and just all coming together to do those kind of fights. And that's very heartwarming. You don't see that all the time. So that is a good side effect of this whole thing. And really, when you're up there, you know, everyone knows what everyone went through, large and small, whether you lost a house or not. I mean, some people didn't, you know, my mother's house is still standing, and that's kind of like our central point for our whole family because it's left. But we all went through evacuation, and we all went through, you know, all the traffic afterwards and everything that's been horrendous. So it's unifying because only we had that experience, whether we're still there or not. So there's this bond now.
Before the fire, you had mentioned that Greenville experienced, well, what it was 10 days of unprecedented 110 degree weather.
2 months.
Oh, 2 months. 10 days, 2 months. Oh my gosh. Have you experienced a change in people's perspective about climate change before and after the fires?
You know, you have your diehards where you're like, your house burned. You saw the flames. You felt the you know, hot weather. And they're still like, it's a hoax. You know, but I think that's only like about 10% of the population. Unfortunately, that's always the 10% that want to talk to reporters. But there's, you know, a good deal.
You're not able to deter them.
Not able to deter everyone. They're like, don't do that. But I think by and large, people are understanding. Oh, I mean, all of us who, I lived up there 20 years and, you know where the river should be in spring, how high it should be. And when you see it not there, you can't not know. Like, you know, when the river in February looks like it does supposed to in September or October, you know you're in trouble. And that was it for us. There was no snowpack in 2020 at all. There had been no snow other than a light dusting. There had been no rain. I mean, we were just set up for this disaster. And then, of course, it rains in the fall of 2021. It finally starts raining after a year without rain or snow. It's just crazy.
But you feel that people's perspectives did shift.
Yeah, I would say so. I'd say anybody who was on the fence and going, oh, I don't know, that's just like a theory or whatever, those people are on the other side. But your diehard people who are, you know, think the UN is out to get them, and there's a little fringe faction of Indian Valley that swears that, you know, the government is trying to burn them out of rural areas and make them live in San Francisco.
I want to ask you about that. I'm going to hold that conversation for a moment, because I think that happens with every freaking fire that there is. Every fire, that there's these magical lasers that come in and destroy the entire town.
When I run across people saying that, I'm like, oh, honey, no one in San Francisco wants you to move there. Trust me.
Okay, you know what? I'm not going to hold the question. How about we take it now? When fires like this happen, there are these conspiracy theories that pop up. It happened with the campfire. It happened with Greenville. It happened recently with Maui, where people do not believe that these fires were a result of human error or natural disaster, but instead that there are these controlled plans that are using things like lasers to strategically take out infrastructure in order to grab the land, gentrify the area, make people, I guess, move to San Francisco because everyone wants to move to San Francisco. I don't know. How do you combat that narrative?
Yeah, well, that is the struggle, right? I mean, a lot of what I think people in my position and in Greenville do is try to go like, hello, was there, this is what happened. Like, you know, we are not a crazy YouTube video, this is what happened. You know? You don't have to believe me, but I was there, you know, or we were there, this is what it was. I also think, you know, the failing of the sciences in schools, right? And people not paying attention, because a lot of people are like, oh, but, you know, everything was burnt out, but there's still a tree. And you're like, do you know how long it takes to cure a tree, to like dry it out so it can be firewood? An awful long time. And the drought will show you that, like, no, it did take out a lot of trees. But we had people afterwards going, there's still a tree standing, so it's a conspiracy. And I'm like, it takes a really long time.
Well, I think people don't understand that. Like, a house is going to go up in fire quicker than trees are in a lot of cases.
And I think a lot of that stuff is just ignorance of not understanding how fire works, not understanding how trees work, I guess. People not understand when Maui, not understanding a brush fire. I mean, not everybody understands how fast a brush fire can spread. It just keeps pushing along with as much fuel as it gets. So I think there's some opportunity really here for education of people to make them understand, you know, this is how, I mean, there's a lot of things that happened in the fire that I didn't understand until it happened on our property. I went in with my press pass before other people could get in, and I went to check things out, and the fire was burning underground. And I didn't know fires could burn underground, but they can.
I don't think a lot of people know that. Yeah.
Because it's dry and you have dead standing snags or whatever, that's fuel and it'll just continue to burn. So on our property, I put out our own fire by myself.
Oh my. Oh my.
With one hose into holes.
Going back to normal, whatever that means, right? Normal. I don't know if there's a semblance of normal so far, you know, the rebuild's still happening. You know, going back to normal, experiencing a lifelong trauma after a devastating natural disaster like the Dixie Fire in Greenville seems almost impossible. Can you read an excerpt from your poem, Back to Normal, where you address this, is it a dichotomy? Like you address this, right? That this experience that you have, that people are telling you everything's back to normal.
Right. So yeah, this is an excerpt from the poem. The agency representative on the other end of the phone asks you to fax your information. You don't have a fax. They say you use the library, the post office. Ma'am, do you not understand that our town burned down? There is no post office, no library, no doctor, no gas station. There was a pile of rubble and bent metal beginning to rust. That's all. The woman on the other end of the phone wants to know where your receipts are. Like you let this happen, you let it burn. And you hang up yelling, there's not a single blade of grass in town. And when you're calm, you'll call back. But that could take weeks. You have no diploma, no birth certificates, no letters, no recommendations, all the proof we need to exist. Your kid gets up at 4 a.m. to get to school on time in another town. Whole feral families walk dazed around campgrounds. We wake up early or we never go to sleep. We get out ahead of road closures and get stuck in neighboring towns needing to pee, and even the donut shop isn't open yet, and it takes 2 hours to go 17 miles. They use helicopters to remove trees. They are felling all the trees. Later, you go for coffee in a neighboring town and run into someone you know, and they tell you they haven't driven through Greenville to see the damage because it's soul damaging, and they are major proponents of self-care. It's not healthy for me to see such devastation, they say. Too depressing. You were reminded of Charles Bukowski, where he says the problem with these people are their cities have never been burned and their mothers were never told to shut up. You keep smiling. Your life too depressing for neighboring town folk. We are back to normal.
But are we? Are we ever back to normal? Oh, he's such good lines in that. And then Bukowski, man. And a man. Walking around feral. Families walking around feral, the imagery of that.
Yeah.
The reality of that. What was the national response to the Greenville Dixie Fire? And how did that differ from other fires happening at the same time? Like there was the Lake Tahoe fire that happened, which I heard about much more coverage than I heard about the Dixie Fire.
So, I mean, another factor is kind of hidden. Got us hidden from national attention for we had a brief moment because your town burns down, but directly right after that was the U.S. troops getting out of Afghanistan and the Tahoe fire. And one of the things we found out that I didn't know beforehand is to get declared a federal national disaster so you can start receiving FEMA and emergency aid can come in is the president has to declare you a disaster, but there's a dollar threshold for that. And so our Greenville is a working class town, right? And so none of those houses are even worth $500,000, if that. Like we lived there because it was an affordable piece of California. Well, five homes in Lake Tahoe burn and they're all $2 million homes. So they reach the threshold, you know, immediately. And we take 3 weeks to reap the threshold. And we had state funding right away because Gavin Newsom declared us, you know, a statewide disaster, but we didn't have the federal assist until we could get over a threshold of millions of dollars. And so you had people who really could use aid right away that had to wait. So, well, because the acreage that burned was all national forest and whatnot, and so that doesn't get counted into anything with a monetary number attached to how many trees burn, only how many houses.
And we only have a few more minutes left in the show, so I do want to talk about your new manuscript that you're working on called Watershed. It's about fire and water. I'm going to throw two questions in together because we only have five more minutes to the end of the show, but I'm going to let everyone know, remember, you can go to our website at ecojusticeradio.org to hear the extended version. Why were you inspired to write this new manual called Watershed? And then after that, I would love for you to read from the piece Water Policy.
Okay. I was inspired to do it because even though I've moved, a little bit has followed with me. And I mean, like, I still smell smoke all the time. If I'm stressed, if I'm tired, the fire is still with me. And I understand from some people I've talked to that that'll follow me the rest of my life, is that smell of burning. I can't leave it. So that inspired me to get back into it. But also walking around as a fire survivor and knowing anything about nature or fire or whatever. And it could be that I'm now in Southern California where half of our area is fake. Just like, you know, we're built in places we shouldn't be and we steal other people's water to be here. But it could be that. But I find such a huge disconnect between, you know, now being in the Greenville diaspora as we're trying to navigate in these new places we're in, and having no one relating to anything has made me really want to write it.
Share with us from Water Policy. We have 3 minutes to the break.
So this is Water Policy. On the first day of your daughter's water policy class at her new unburned school in her new unburned town in Southern California, the professor asks where we get our water from and what do we use it for. The Colorado students say it's for pools and front lawns, and they trail off in the way suburban kids do when imagining the world outside of strip malls and phone apps. My kid murmurs agriculture and drinking water and life itself of the Feather River and the Oroville Dam. And how do you relate to a class of people who've never seen the dried rings scarring the red rock and the houseboats circling the drain? It's enough to wither you, made your cracked dry lake bed, now laying it isolated and utterly alone. So that is Water Policy.
Thank you. I'm talking about your daughter's experience, I think. Right. Well, before we wrap up, again, I want to remind our listeners that we are going to continue this conversation. We're going to read a little bit more of the Margaret's poetry, go into a few more questions. But before we do so, Margaret, where can people buy your poetry publication, Burn Scars, and your other publications that you have, and also keep up with you and follow you on social media?
Sure. So I have a website, margaretalesiagarcia.com, and any events I'm doing and the books are all on there with links of where to purchase them. So that's all on one site. Takes you to other sites, but it's all on one place. And I'm on Twitter and or X for the time being, and Instagram, Writer Chick Mama.
Writer Chick Mama. C-H-I-C-K?
Yes. M-A-M-A. So.
Well, everyone, please check out Writer Chick Mama. And get your work. Go to your website. What's the website again?
MargaretAlesiaGarcia.com.
And we'll also be putting that information on our social media as well as our website at ecojusticeradio.com. And thank you again, Margaret, for joining us. And I really appreciate you being on the show and sharing your work and really all the amazing earth consciousness that you're putting out there for us. Thank you for bringing this to light.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore other shows, visit our website at ecojusticeradio.org and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Burn Scars, A Poetic Reckoning with Wildfires. Thank you to our guest, Margaret Alija Garcia, author and poet published by El Martillo Press. And always thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media. You can find us at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Adventures in Waste. And if you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. Executive producer Jack Eye, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blakewake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Boogie Cat, meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events.